Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Monday, 21st of September, 2020, and we're having some lovely struggles as with getting this podcast online. We're in a new semi-lockdown situation here in Denmark, but hopefully we can get this one out. And we have interesting developments after Friday that we close in the U.S. We tested that key range support low in the S&P below 3,300. Didn't close on the lows, but we've seen some weakening again here to start the week. You can see on slide one, focusing in on that at sub 3,300 low, the cash index actually did test a bit more lower than in the regular session on Friday. And you can notice in the red, I have the 55-day moving average. It's one of those key moving averages many folks look at for trend support. So basically, we're opening up the risk here of further downside, and that's underlined as well of the NASDAQ 100 trading below that 11,000 level we've been talking about. And I guess the next level, something like 3,100, 3,105 would be the 200-day moving average if you look at your cash levels, and 9,500. Still quite far off, Peter. But sentiment is just not holding up here very well. And there's some other, and we'll get to this, there's a lot going on over the weekend as well. But sentiment not really looking so great as we start the week.
No, that would be a fantasy. We really having downward pressure across the board. I think we still have hangovers from that FOMC meeting. Maybe that was just an excuse, but at least that's the hangover. And then we have the news over the weekend with which we'll talk about in a few minutes, I guess. The Nicolas, CEO and co-founder, is stepping down. I think that is. Will have some sentiment impact, at least on technology stocks, and whether that creates enough ripple effects across other markets, equity markets, we'll have to see. But it really looks like a very beautiful setup, I think, for shorts coming in here. So it'll be interesting to see where we can find those supports. I think it's very critical in the S&P 500, as you show on that slide one. So but we have other things to talk about also, HSBC and the likes. But we'll take that in a few minutes.
Yeah, just to run down, we're going to get to that Nicolas story in a second. A very dramatic development there is the CEO and co-founder stepping down. This let's say this stinks to high heaven. That's one way to put it. We also have Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying on Friday, and that sets up an interesting battle in Congress, where in the Senate, where the Republicans and Trump are trying to move very quickly to nominate a new Supreme Court justice. With less than 60 days to the U.S. election, very controversial, obviously a very ugly move relative to what happened back in 2016 when Obama tried to do something similar, but it was 8 to 9 months before the election, his nomination. But back then it was a Republican-controlled Senate. That's why he could not get his nominee through. This time they have the control, but will those wobbling few senators that would make the difference in the vote to come through? It could really set up a charged situation into the election. And if no new Supreme Court justice is in place, you also have the risk of a split decision if there's some sort of constitutional crisis developing over the election result. So there's a lot of moving parts there. It could also mean that the election becomes a referendum on abortion if Trump tries to move forward with a candidate and that candidate is a pro-abortion or anti-abortion candidate. The other story, I didn't see as much play in the press. I was a bit surprised, but this AstraZeneca trial, and New York Times running a story where they say a second case, according to their sources, may have had the same extremely rare ailment, transverse myelitis, not that I know what that is, that could have been triggered by the vaccine. If that is the case, if the third case pops up in these trials, it could mean the entire that entire vaccine effort would have to be scrapped. I don't think the market would absorb that very well if that's the case. Too early days, but it's an interesting and concerning story there. And there was another major vaccine effort from Johnson & Johnson and their partner that uses a similar sort of technology, as far as I understand, for delivering that vaccine into the human body. So that would mean that other candidates would have to come on board with maybe a different style of vaccine. But back to the Nicolas story, Peter, this is a huge one. This is a bombshell. And what's going to shape up today, you think, in terms of the the stock price?
Well, for perspective for everyone, slide two, you can see that big pop a couple of weeks ago was the $2 billion equity stake by General Motors into the company, really validating their technology and their vision. Then already the day after, beautiful timing, the short seller research company Hindenburg Research reported a very long a range, a series of allegations against the company. And the so-called response that the co-founder CEO Trevor Milton quickly said would come was very, very weak. And eventually there was basically no defense except for that they refused all the allegations. And then over the past 3 days, 4 days, we had the Justice Department and the SEC opening up a probe for fraud at Nikola based on all these allegations. The company came forward over the weekend, said that the accusations of this prototype rolling down a hill and then make it look like it was actually driving on its own torque or its own internal propulsion mechanism was then accepted by Nikola as being true. So the allegation there was true. And now this morning, the board of directors are saying that the CEO and co-founder is stepping down and the chairman will take over as interim CEO. And I think it will be absolute carnage when the market opens in New York. I mean, it could go as far as to $10. You have a very loyal crowd that have supported the stock, as I wrote in our quick take, which you can see on analysis.saxo this morning. I mean, the stock price actually held up pretty well, given all the allegations. So and I think this is just this is the drop. I think there's a very, very high risk of that a lot of these fraud allegations are actually correct now. And let's see where it ends. And I think it also puts GM in a very ugly position, because they said last week that they had a very smart due diligence team with very seasoned people, and they had done all the right due diligence techniques and work into it. And a $2 billion stake could now be, vanishing very quickly. And I think that's very embarrassing for the CEO and GM as a whole. So I'm very curious to see what their response will be this morning.
We're jumping a bit in the slide deck, but since we're on the issue of electric vehicles, we can't not talk about Tesla, which has its big moment in the spotlight tomorrow with this battery day. Some people comparing this almost to the big splashes that Apple made in the past with Steve Jobs on their yearly conference. What are the hopes around this battery day today? And will the Nikola story, do you think, is Tesla really trading on fundamentals or not? But will this, do you think, play into anything Tesla is doing here or into the stock price ahead of tomorrow?
I think there's a finite pool of investors that are playing this electrical vehicle space. So when you have the troubles in Nikola, I think that part of that finite pool, at least here in short term, will shift and bet more heavily on Tesla. So I wouldn't be surprised if Tesla actually gets momentum out of the Nikola story this morning. Let's see. But yeah, it's correct. They have their annual shareholder meeting tomorrow, and they have the battery day. It's 16:30 EST. So Eastern Standard Time, and there's a big hope that they will come out with the big news on their batteries. They produce a battery together in a partnership with Panasonic in their Nevada Gigafactory. And Nikkei, the Japanese news outlet, reported in August that they had seen internal documents showing that Panasonic is planning to do a $100 million investment into the Nevada Gigafactory to upgrade the production lines for new cell production. So it really indicates that there is a new battery cell design coming through. The two most likely outcomes that we'll see on Battery Day tomorrow from Tesla is probably a higher energy density, and then mostly likely a lower price point, because they probably found out a new way to do more streamlined manufacturing. If that's the case, they'll just increase the lead over their competitors. I think this whole car industry and the electric vehicle transformation is shaping up to be an absolutely firework over the coming decade. I think it's super interesting, actually.
Yeah, I think as well, I'm super interested to see what they're doing. There's some talk about if they're able to do this new process, it could mean something like 50% greater power density, which would be an absolute game changer, getting that kind of power density change, because the battery, of course, is so heavy and such an expensive component. But I'm not going to speculate. It could also just be that range extension or lifetime extension, the million miles so-called battery. But Ola, oil markets trade day to day, and they're trading on this whole supply and demand adjustment that's taking place after COVID-19. I'll let you talk about that, but as a transition into that, on what timescale do you feel like oil is looking at this whole transition to EVs?
Oh, I think it's potentially coming going to happen faster than we expect, but at the same time, we also have to acknowledge that we still have a global rising population. So what it may just mean in the beginning, at least, is that the number of petrol cars on the road will not rise because the increase in demand will come from or because EV will supply the growth that is expected to continue for another number of years. But obviously this year with Tesla and its performance and it has really obviously put everyone else on the block and the heads on the block, and they have to respond, and they have to respond aggressively. And that could potentially mean that when we look back in the history books in a few years from now, then 2020 potentially could be that year where we had a bit of a quantum leap. So it's remains to be seen, but it's not going to it will add to the overall story that demand growth in oil will continue to taper off over the coming years. Whether we have seen the peak already, as BP alluded to last week, in the worst case scenario for the oil industry, that is probably too early. But focusing in on what's happening right now, the market is still really just coming to terms with the verbal threat or the attack we had last week from the Saudi oil minister, basically going on the attack against the cheaters within the OPEC Plus group, but also short sellers. And I highlight here on slide 8 where you can see this is the gross short, i.e. the short positions held by hedge funds in WTI and Brent. And you can see it's been rising quite rapidly over the past couple of months. And this really highlights that while the price was not really doing much until a few weeks ago when we had the correction in the stock market, the fundamentals in the oil market had already started to weaken back in July and August, and short sellers had started to emerge on the back of that. It's only now that when we saw the breakdown because of the risk sentiment came off with the stock market sell-off, then it suddenly became more apparent that there was just quite a big stock, a big short in the market. So the Saudi minister, not sure he's reading the COD reports on a weekly basis, but he saw that as a worry, but also as an opportunity to really to squeeze some shorts out. And I think that's primarily what we saw Thursday and Friday. And as you can see on the chart, we have now back to a key area of resistance here. The 50 and 200-day moving averages, they're coming in at 43.70 and 44.10. That's really quite a big band of resistance. And in order to break through, then the market has to believe that the Saudi threat will be followed up by action, that potentially will start to talk about extending cuts further or even make additional cuts in order to balance the market.
Okay. Interesting to see how oil markets shape up from here. And then we're looking at over at FX, the driving factor here, for, bar none, is the Japanese yen and that big move last week. I have actually a monthly chart. It's a bit in the headline, talks about weekly, but a monthly chart so we can get that perspective all the way back to 2012 and before on slide 4. We see how big a level we're trying into here. Yes, we had that spike around the whole COVID panic. I'd sort of discount that one because the price action only tarried there for a matter of a few hours. But the lowest weekly close last week since 2016, when we traded down towards 100, the obvious next major chart focus if we trade lower and hold lower here, and it looks like we are. And yesterday, or last week, I should say, every single day saw falling price action. It really looks like there's been a secular shift in attitude towards the Japanese yen. That is driving things here. And I think it looks like a very strong momentum move. I also like to look at it in terms of other yen crosses, not just dollar yen. And then a bit confused here in the broader market, how much this, we're seeing the dollar a bit weaker elsewhere. How much of that is being driven by dollar yen flows? Normally, in the crosses, you see dollar and yen directionally moving in sync. So in other words, if the yen is strong, the dollar is also strong in general elsewhere. So I still like the yen stronger here, but I also like not just in dollar yen, but looking at it crosses, especially like Aussie yen, as we're seeing risk sentiment here. And I'm a bit scratching my head around the strength in the Aussie recently. I think a little bit too much China focus on the Aussie, but also euro yen. And interested to see again, is it just yen strength here, or is the dollar also, or is there some sort of shift underway? So euro dollar needs to stay below 119 and certainly below 120 to argue that this is mostly a brief aberration here. And then we look at slide 5, Aussie dollar, again, maximum uncertainty, middle of the range. We've had this very sort of ugly and slow uptrend here. And it just doesn't fit to my mind as well. We're seeing iron ore having another weak session overnight, and we're seeing weak risk sentiment. It just doesn't fit to me to see the Aussie up here, but it's not falling through to the downside at all. So we would need to see that happen before we can believe that there is some weakness coming in there.
John, can I just add on that one? In the weekly speculative data, it was actually last week was the first week in the for several months that the speculators finally managed to get their position turned around to be a net long. So obviously they've been missing out on quite a bit of that move, but they are now actually back into a long position. So whether that's going to have any impact or not, but at least there's no short covering that has been coming into the market. That's now done, and the question is now if they've been buying at the top. But that remains to be seen, obviously.
Yeah, and really it's been, you know, it isn't an uptrend, but again, it's not a pretty one, and it needs some kind of resolution one way or another. Let's get to some other stories. We're out on Asia a little bit with that last comment. HSBC, what's going on here? Why is it down to its lowest level in such a long time here, Peter?
Well, generally, there is a pressure on the profitability of banks in general, flatter yield curves, lower rates overall, slowdown in economic growth, higher risk on the credit loan books, etc. But then also, Global Times reported on Saturday that that China might move to put HSBC on the unreliability entity list, which is basically an aim where they try to punish firms and organizations that damage the national security, which is quite interesting given the accusations from the West recently, where HSBC was seen as helping around the whole situation in Hong Kong and their struggle with mainland China, very political, and it just shows you that HSBC with the roots to UK really lack the protection which I think US banks and or European continent banks have in international markets. I think HSBC is very vulnerable. They don't have any friends, I think, political friends in either UK and China. Everyone is upset about HSBC. So they are in a very ugly position. And I think it goes back to what you and I talked about, John, a couple of weeks ago, that maybe HSBC will have to split. It is probably very difficult to be a global bank with that footprint operating so many political hotspots if you're not either a Chinese or a US bank or maybe even a European continent bank. Being a UK bank, I think, is probably not the best foundation to be global or being in these political hotspots. So the share price is down to, Bloomberg has 25-year low. I don't really get that because if you adjust for all the rights issues, etc., it's actually not a 25-year low. It's just around the lows from early 2009. But nevertheless, down more 55% this year and absolutely terrible for HSBC. But I think it's a symptom of what we're seeing in the entire banking industry. The whole industry is really on the ropes here. And it comes at the same time as Ant Group is just lifting their share offering to $35 billion, which would be a world record. And it will be the biggest financial institution just behind JP Morgan Chase if they list at the current valuations that are now being rumored in Shanghai and Hong Kong. So, but our great colleagues out in Asia will do an IPO analysis pre of that IPO. So stay tuned for that one on analysis.saxo.
Yeah, and then we had last week, it was a real big week for the IPOs with the Unity out on Friday. And one of these really ugly first days. I mean, the irony being, it's a great first day for the company itself, and especially for insiders with that massive valuation and huge opening level around $75. But then it sort of sold off for a lot of the day. Didn't enjoy a strength that lasted all day long.
Exactly. I don't want to put too many words on this. It's already becoming a long podcast here, but I just want to flag the Unity that, as you said, it really popped a lot from the IPO price of 52. So the insiders did well. The initial speculations and positions put on in the first couple of hours didn't do that well. I think it very much is a mirror image of what we've seen with Snowflake. But so Unity will be in focus again today. A lot of volatility, probability skewed towards downward pressure, given also the weakening sentiment overall in US equities and in particular in the technology space. So watch that one if you want a little bit of action. I think that will definitely come for Unity today.
Right. Now, before we get to the calendar, Ole, did you want to pull anything out or highlight anything in the weekly cut update of US futures positioning you have on slide 9?
Yeah, just the fact that that we continue to see very, very strong demand for the grain sector, especially soybeans. We did see a strong rally continue last week, but it also highlights too a couple of markets where investors really got it completely wrong last week. We saw nat gas, we saw a build there in the net long. We saw a build in coffee to the highest level in since 2016, and last week both natural gas and coffee both collapsed for various reasons. I'll highlight that in today's analysis.saxo update, so you can find it there. But the appetite for grains remains very strong, and obviously that needs to be continued to be supported by fundamentals. So far it is, but it's one we should keep an eye on.
All right. I think the focus on the calendar is actually not on our calendar. I think one of the key things we need to watch is the political temperature in the U.S. here. This creates a lot of new bad blood in an already very partisan environment. And at stake could be the status of that stimulus coming through, the next round of stimulus, which will be key for the U.S. numbers and maybe even for sentiment, or certainly even for sentiment if this drags on till past the election. So I think that's really one of the keys here, more than a lot of the specifics you're seeing on the calendar on slide 10. Lots of central bank things to talk about if we wanted to. I think the one to pull out is the New Zealand RBNZ. If this kiwi remains this strong, they have a lot of talking to do to jawbone that currency lower. We also have Fed Chair Powell out twice this week, before a House on Wednesday and before a Senate panel with Secretary Mnuchin on Thursday. And we have these Wednesday, we have these flash PMIs from around the world, and particularly interesting perhaps for Eurozone with the very ugly resurgence in COVID-19 numbers, and particularly in France, but other countries as well. So a lot more headlines to watch this week, and the heat level, if it wasn't hot enough, getting certainly at maximum temperature as we head into the final sprint into the U.S. election. I have a piece out on analysis.saxo. I'll be tweeting that out later for a look at some key dates there. For now, we'll call it a day and see where things stand tomorrow with the next Saxo market call for today. Thanks for joining.